From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we conclude our series on TV, featuring stars of current and classic TV shows. Today, children's TV. We'll hear from Fred Rogers, the host of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the longest-running kid show on network TV, Annette Funicello, the most popular Mouseketeer on the Mickey Mouse Club, and Keith Scott, who wrote a history of Rocky and Bullwinkle and did the voice of Bullwinkle for the recent film. Children's TV, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Both major presidential candidates spent Labor Day campaigning in the so-called battleground states, where polls show a virtual dead heat. Gore is in a 27-hour marathon campaign swing. Bush went to Illinois this morning, as in Michigan this evening. The Bush campaign is denying that the Republican nominee is losing ground to Gore now that the polls show a very close race. Steve Inskeep is traveling with the Bush campaign.
Well, the Bush campaign keeps saying this is exactly where they expect it to be, and in fairness, they in fact have said all summer long they expect this race to be a dead heat about the time it gets to Labor Day, and that is approximately where we are, according to most polls. But as this race has become closer, as Bush's lead has evaporated, Bush has become more aggressive. And his speech today, his first speech of Labor Day in Naperville, Illinois, was much more aggressive, going after Al Gore's integrity, going after his truthfulness, saying we need plain-speaking people in the White House, and suggesting we need no more of these words like no controlling legal authority, mocking a phrase that Al Gore used to try to defend himself against campaign finance allegations.
Steve Inskeep of NPR News with the Bush campaign in Pittsburgh. Meanwhile, the vice president made a stop in Pittsburgh today as part of his 27-hour campaign tour to mark Labor Day. Mark Newtbar reports from member station WDUQ.
After making overnight and early morning stops in the swing states of Michigan and Florida, the vice president came to Pittsburgh to take part in the tail end of the nation's largest Labor Day parade. He spoke to a rally of mostly union members where he told the crowd of more than 2,000 that he will support working families.
I'm asking for your support on the basis of the better, fairer, stronger economy that we're going to create together in the next 4 years. I think it's time to raise the minimum wage $1 an hour and have a living wage.
Gore also focused on keeping the budget balanced and placing Social Security funds in a so-called lockbox where it cannot be used for any other reason. The Reverend Jesse Jackson joined Gore at the rally, asking voters of all walks of life to rally behind the Democratic ticket. From Pittsburgh, Gore traveled to Louisville, Kentucky. For NPR News, I'm Mark Newtbar in Pittsburgh.
Firefighters in the northern Rocky Mountains have had some help from cooler temperatures, rain, and snow, but they warn that fire season in Montana and Idaho isn't over yet. The improved weather conditions also made it possible for officials in Wyoming to reopen the Devil's Tower National Monument, which had been closed over the weekend because of a fast-growing wildfire that spread to more than 1,500 acres. Despite the weather, firefighters are still contending with 81 large fires around the country, from Arkansas and Mississippi to California and Oregon. The National Interagency Fire Center says the current fires have burned nearly 1.7 million acres. This is NPR News. Consumer protection officials in Venezuela say Bridgestone Firestone Company has agreed to recall more than 60,000 tires that have been linked to traffic accidents. The company will take back all its Wilderness AT tires circulating in the country. The agency says Venezuelan prosecutors will continue their investigation into 46 deaths that have been linked to the tires. The United Nations is sponsoring what's believed to be the biggest gathering of international officials ever this week at the Millennium Summit. Linda Fasulo has a preview from New York.
Billed as the largest diplomatic gathering in history, the three-day meeting is expected to draw some 150 top world leaders, with President Clinton slated to deliver the opening address Wednesday. Mr. Clinton is expected to stress America's need to stay engaged around the globe and find ways of dealing with new challenges, including AIDS. The president is also likely to provide plans for helping the United Nations respond more rapidly to global crises. Numerous face-to-face meetings with key leaders, such as Russia's President Vladimir Putin and Chinese leader Jiang Zemin, are also scheduled. And in an effort to restart the Middle East peace process, he will meet with Israeli President Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo in New York.
It's now up to union workers to decide whether to accept a tentative contract negotiated last night between the Bridgestone Firestone Company and the United Steelworkers. The deal affects more than 8,000 union workers who work at 9 Bridgestone Firestone plants in the United States. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our series on television concludes today with kids' shows. We start with a kids' show that adults love, too.
Boris, why you're coughing?
I'm used to breathing good old city smog, Natasha. This fresh air is killing me.
A lot of baby boomers learned about the Cold War from Rocky and Bullwinkle as they constantly tried to foil the plans of the two evil spies, Boris Badenov and Natasha Fatal. The cartoon series premiered in 1959. My guest Keith Scott did the voices of Bullwinkle and the narrator in the recent Rocky and Bullwinkle film. Scott is also the historian for J. Ward Productions, the animation studio that created Rocky and Bullwinkle. Scott wrote a book about the studio called The Moose That Roared. The voice of Bullwinkle was created by Bill Scott, who's no relation to Keith. Keith Scott told me how the voice was originally conceived.
Originally, Bullwinkle was always conceived as kind of, you know, I guess a generic dumb cartoon voice where in old cartoons, you always heard the, which way did he go, George? Gee, Rocky. You know, so it was always these dumb sort of characters, as they used to call them. And so he made him what he described as a smart goof. In other words, there was a lot more going on in Bullwinkle's head, even though he had this kind of dumb voice.
Right. Now, what do you do to get that voice? Where do you place your voice in your head?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to physically describe where my throat is doing that, but I think it's because for, I guess, 40 years of my 46 years, I've been the world's biggest fan of this, so it's just osmosis. Listening, and also Bill Scott gave me all the original recording session tapes, so you kind of became like a fly on the wall. You could hear the actors developing these voices or get inside the actors' heads rather than just the character.
So really, I can't describe how I do this. There's a lot of air there, and a lot of diaphragm, and also a lot of charisma, I think.
You've also done the voice of the announcer, and you do the announcer's voice for the new Rocky and Bullwinkle movie. Who was the original announcer?
Well, that was William Conrad, who was, some of your listeners may remember the TV series Cannon, and he was kind of a fairly rotund guy, but of course, you know, all of these great voice actors that they used were originally in the days of network radio drama and comedy. So William Conrad was really well known as the voice of Matt Dillon in the original Gunsmoke.
And he had this very deep, rolling sort of voice. And I'm that man, Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
But of course, when he did the show, the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, he was a lot more cartoony, so it was,
in our last episode, those intrepid heroes, Rocky and Bullwinkle, were being followed by that vicious villain, Boris Badenoff.
That's great. I think it's really funny that you should be both doing the voice of the goofy Bullwinkle and the authoritative announcer.
It's so weird, because in this new movie, there's even a line where Bullwinkle's walking through this angry crowd at the university, Wasamariu, which they recreated from the old cartoons. And the narrator says,
and our insipid hero made it through the crowd.
And then Bullwinkle says,
don't you mean intrepid hero?
And there's a little pause and he goes,
no.
No. And did you do those voices back to back, having a conversation with yourself, or did you record them separately?
Pretty much back to back on the read-throughs and the pre-record. But as you know, on a big budget picture like this, eventually everything gets replaced. And I think for consistency of character, it's better if you read just one character's lines. In fact, even in the old Warner Brothers cartoons, Mel Blanc always used to admit that he'd do all of Bugs Bunny's lines first and then come back and do Yosemite Sam, or he wouldn't have a voice box left.
Right. Now, you don't do the voice of the Russian spy, Boris Badenov, in the movie, but you have done Boris Badenov for other versions of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
I do Boris's voice in the movie. There's a short section where you see the characters in normal cell animation.
Mm-hmm. You want to give us a little taste of Boris?
This Boris Badenov, incompetent little Pennsylvanian spy. Oh boy, Natasha.
What a great laugh. Now, who is that voice based on?
Well, Paul Frees, the originator of the voice of Boris Badenov and many, many other voices on the old cartoons, actually admitted that he took Boris's voice from a veteran character actor named Akim Tamarov, who, you know, I guess you could see him in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil and a lot of old films from the 40s, like For Whom the Bell Tolls. And he was always these little, very charismatic villains, often with that Balkan dialect. So he took a bit of that and then a little bit of this character that a Jewish comic called Bert Gordon did on the Eddie Cantor Show. It was one of those weekly characters that used to appear on old-time radio. The audience would look forward to it. It was called the Mad Russian. And it was always, how do you do? So I think he just kind of combined those two voices, and we had this crazy villain.
For anyone who's never seen Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, what's the basic premise?
Well, the premise is that these two zany-looking heroes, you know, the design is just so cheap and funny. This very tall moose and this very short squirrel are best buddies. They live in Frostbite Falls, Minnesota. And in every adventure, they travel the world and foil the plans of this Cold War villain couple, Boris Badenov and Natasha Fatal. And they do it just by lucking out, mainly. So the whole thing is a takeoff on melodrama and white-hatted heroes. But it's just done in a very light-hearted, charming, satirical style. But the main thing to say about these cartoons is that they all eventuated when there was so much competition of bland cartoons, you know, cats chasing mice and that sort of thing, so that these stood out for anyone who Bill Scott used to call the smart kids. Suddenly picked these out as something special because at the same time that, you know, Yogi Bear was stealing a pie off the windowsill, Rocky and Bullwinkle were satirizing politics and TV executives and things that really were way over the kids' heads, so that Bill Scott and Jay Ward used to say you could keep coming back to these cartoons from young childhood through early high school and then into adulthood on three different levels, then you'd keep getting things that you didn't get the previous time.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of one of the early Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons? And in this one, the spies Boris and Natasha have drained Lake Salle de Bain, which, of course, in French means bathroom.
And
they've drained the lake. They've basically pulled a plug to drain the lake in order to get at a trunk of treasure buried at the bottom. And after they get
The treasure chest of Montezum.
Yes, I kept expecting Montezuma's revenge to be the end of this. But after they get the chest with the treasure in it, they can't open the chest. So they throw it off a little mountain, hoping that when it hits the ground, it will open. But what happens is Boris Badenov ends up falling off the little mountain with the chest, and the chest lands on top of him. As he's falling, Natasha yells some advice to him.
Don't worry, darling. Remember, this is just cartoon.
Oop.
Boris, are you all right?
Natasha, I just found out what happens when a cartoon chest falls on a cartoon character.
What?
It hurts!
And what's more, darling?
What could be what's more?
The chest still isn't open.
Fui and double fui.
That voice, Bullwinkle, Where have I heard that voice?
I heard something like it once when I dropped a chicken bone in the garbage disposal.
That does it, Natasha. Come on. We're going to get an A-bomb.
A-bomb?
A-bomb, come on.
Did you hear that, Bullwinkle?
Sure, they repeated it twice.
Do you know what A-bomb means?
Certainly. A-bomb is what some people call our program.
I don't think that's so funny.
Neither do they, apparently.
Do you know why Jay Ward decided to have these two Russian spies and make it a Cold War comedy?
I believe that was Bill Scott's decision. He wrote the script for the pilot film, and I think he wrote it in around about Christmas of 1957, and that, of course, was Sputnik era, and it was when the tensions of the Cold War were, at their height. I think it was just topical, and he was a very topical person. He was, if he hadn't been in animation, I'm sure he would have been one of these comedians like Stan Freberg, you know, who was doing whatever was in the news at the time. Not mother-in-law jokes, but I'm talking like political jokes, you know. So I think then when they created the characters, they based the look of it kind of as a tribute to Charles Adams, the cartoonist, with the Adams family. Gomez and Morticia, as they were named in the TV show, they never had a name in the old panel cartoons, looked very much like Boris and Natasha. I think once that story developed and then the show was picked up and renewed, they decided to keep those villains because the Cold War had continued, and they had ended up in the first 40 episodes as very funny, bumbling characters that looked viable for a long life.
Do you know anything about Jay Ward's and Bill Scott's politics?
The only thing I knew is that, as I mentioned, Bill Scott's son said that my dad was a screaming lefty, and he was. I mean, he was involved in many causes. He did commercials for Mental Health Foundation. He was a member of the Civil Liberties Union. And Jay Ward, strangely enough, was a staunch Republican. And yet these two got on and giggled all day long, and they were totally politically opposed.
Many of the jokes in Rocky and Bullwinkle had to go over the heads of kids who were watching. Did Jay Ward care whether kids got the jokes or not?
I don't think he really cared, because he was clever enough to realize that they could see it, especially very small kids could watch the cartoons and be enchanted by the odd-looking design and just the storyline itself. There was a sense of adventure that even the youngest audiences got. But he always spoke very intelligently about his audiences. Whenever he got dictation from the networks or the sponsor saying, too many adult references, too much showbiz material, you're going to offend some Greek national if you do that dialect, or complaint after complaint. And he would always say, the kids are going to get this. Audiences have brains. So both of them presumed a degree of intelligence in the viewers, which network people were renowned for doing the complete opposite,
My guest is Keith Scott, the official historian of Jay Ward Productions, which created Rocky and Bullwinkle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Keith Scott. His book, The Moose That Roared, tells the history of Rocky and Bullwinkle. He did the voices of Bullwinkle and the announcer in the recent Rocky and Bullwinkle film. I grew up on cartoons. You grew up on cartoons. I know some of my dreams were affected by cartoons. I used to have this recurring dream where I'd be like driving in a convertible and I'd kind of crash into something and I'd go kind of like flying up into the sky and then slowly fly down, as only happens in cartoons. But I'm wondering if any of your sense of if any of your dreams or things like that were influenced at all by cartoon physics.
That could well be because I'm always thinking in terms of gags. You know, when they were doing the old Laurel and Hardy shorts here in Hollywood or Culver City, Stan Laurel had that kind of a mind. If he was driving along and had to brake quickly, his mind would immediately snap to what would happen in a gag, even though he almost just got killed, you know. I tend to be like that. It's this constant exposure to the comedy and the dynamics of cartoons and the rhythm of comedy. So I don't know if that's a good thing or bad.
Do you have any strong feelings about parents and TV executives who actually worry about cartoon violence?
Yeah, I think that's a little exaggerated because they always seem to quote the Roadrunner. And the violence only happens to the coyote in that, and it's self-inflicted. His traps don't work, or he keeps falling off a cliff and ending up looking like an accordion when he walks, and then suddenly he's back to normal again. I'm convinced that all the kids I knew when I was very young knew that it was just a cartoon, in inverted commas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was a gag.
You know, I'm thinking in one of the early Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, Rocky and Bullwinkle make a joke about how the network executives don't like violent cartoons. And this,
yes,
this was back in the 50s or early 60s, this cartoon.
Yeah, I think that what happened was that they had drawn them in one episode as if they were going to fall into a cannibal pot on this island of Rikki Tikki. And they got some dictation from the network saying, well, we won't allow cannibalism with our characters. And Jay Ward actually sent a serious letter saying, cannibalism? To eat a moose and squirrel? and that was publicized in Newsweek. And then about the second storyline after that, there was a scene where Rocky and Bullwinkle are captured by a gigantic Native American and tied to a stake and just about to be set fire to. And Rocky whips out a contract and says, the network says, no cannibalism on TV. So he was always biting the hand that fed him. He was kind of a maverick. I'm sure he was one of those people in those days. They used to mutter and shake their heads and say, I don't know, you know, can we end this contract as soon as possible? This guy's too much trouble.
You started off doing voices for cartoons and commercials in Australia. Mm-hmm. What kinds of characters on the cartoons and commercials?
Very similar to what the Jay Ward actors did, because when you're doing cartoons, sometimes they'll show you a model sheet of a character, and they say, well, it's kind of like, you know, and then generally when they say that, it means it's either an impersonation of a famous, you know, actor or an exaggeration of that person. So there's a local cartoon series that we make in Sydney for... based on a German property. Of course, it's redubbed when it goes back to Europe, but I do the two villainous characters in that, and I based
one of them on this very sort of temperamental character that this radio actor here in Hollywood called Joseph Kearns used to play Mr. Wilson on Dennis the Menace, you see.
And then his offsider was called James. And they were just kidding around when we saw this little penguin, this very obsequious little penguin. And for some reason, they called him James. So everyone just looked at each other and said, James Mason.
So I've got this little penguin who talks like James Mason. Yes, master, whatever you say.
It's funny, because one of the things you have to do while you're doing all these voices is drop your Australian accent. Like, you can't do Bullwinkle with an Australian accent. Or maybe you could. That would be interesting.
Well, I don't know about that, mate.
Right. So you had to learn to speak American, among other things.
Yes, I think it's because of my interest in animation history and so on. I've kind of had the American dialects in my head for so many decades that it's very easy for me to hear with a pair of headphones on if I'm doing the accent correctly, you know. And also with British voices, I mean, I can put on a very broad Australian, you know, like Paul Hogan, you know, one of those Australians.
Right.
And then I think it's just through constant listening to tapes of famous people that I could go from, you know, doing Paul Hogan to a very well-known English voice like Alec Guinness.
I want you to build that bridge, and officers will do the work of enlisted men.
And then go to some American voice, like Bullwinkle Boos. Or even an amalgam, you know, like an American star, but with one of those odd accents, like Schwarzenegger, who's like,
I am a cybernetic organism, living tissue over metallic parts.
or Stallone, which is kind of almost a cartoon voice in himself.
I need no manager, you know.
That's true. It is really almost a cartoon voice in itself.
It is. It's very, you know, because that scene in Rocky with Burgess Meredith where he said, come on, kid, listen, I got pain, I got experience.
Oh, I got pain, I got experience too, you know.
Keith Scott, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry, and I've just got a couple of friends here who just want to say goodbye.
Well, thanks a lot, Terry. Bullwinkle J. Moose here, and doing your show has been kind of a breath of fresh air. You get it? I said,
oh, go away, Moose. That was stupid.
Well, at least I'm consistent.
That's great. Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you a lot, Terry.
Keith Scott recorded earlier this summer. His book is called The Moose That Roared. More on Kids TV in the second half of the show. In the meantime, here's a song from Schoolhouse Rock, sung by Dave Frischberg and the show's music director, Bob Durow, from their forthcoming CD, Who's On First? I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
I got three favorite cars that get most of my job done. Yeah.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
I got and, but, and, are. That will get you pretty far. Dig this. And, that's an additive, like this and that. And then there's but, when you say, mommy, I won't do this, but I will do that. And then there's R, O-R, this or that, a choice. And but R will get you pretty far. Now sing the song.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up two box cars and making them run right like this. Bread and butter, milk and honey, peas and rice. Hey, that's nice. Dirty but happy, digging and scratching, losing his shoe and a button or two. He was poor but honest, sad but true. Ooh, boo, hoo, boo. Now sing it.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking two words to one when you have a choice like this one. Either now or later.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from museumshop.com, an online boutique of products from museums around the world, including the Louvre in Paris and the British Museum in London, museumshop.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hey, kids! What time is it?
It's Halloween Unity time!
Coming up, our program on children's TV continues with Annette Funicello, the most popular Mouseketeer on the Mickey Mouse Club, and Fred Rogers, the host of the longest-running kid show on network TV, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this final day of our series on classic and current TV shows, we're focusing on children's TV.
Mickey Mouse Club, Mickey Mouse Club, Mickey Mouse Club, Mickey Mouse Club. Who's the leader of the club that's made for you and me? M-I-C-K-E-Y, M-O-U-S-E. Hey there, hi there, ho there, you're as welcome as can be.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E. That scratchy record is the Mickey Mouse March, the song that opened each edition of the Mickey Mouse Club. The show premiered in 1955, and the mouse-eared kids on the show became celebrities. The most popular of all was Annette Funicello. Her popularity outlasted her adolescence. After the show ended in 1958, she had pop hits and starred in beach blanket movies. Then she left show business to raise her children, and we saw her mostly on Skippy peanut butter commercials. In 1987, she starred in a send-up of her own beach movies, Back to the Beach. That same year, she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. I spoke with Annette Funicello in 1994.
You must hear this all the time, but, you know, I grew up watching the Mickey Mouse Club, and of course, like every kid who watched it, I wanted to be a Mouseketeer. And I remember one of my neighbors, who was about my age, you know, she was a girl, one day I saw her and she had these mouse ears on and I thought, oh God, I'm so jealous. She's a Mouseketeer now. How did she manage to do this? And of course I later figured out she just probably went to Disneyland or something and bought them. But you know, those mouse ears were such a status symbol when you were a kid. How did you feel the first time you saw the mouse ears and put them on?
Well, it was a shock because I think the first thing we thought, especially the boys, was, what do you mean I have to wear those things on my head?
Yeah, they were really stupid looking.
Yes, and it ruined the boys' pomp.
Right.
So it was quite a shock to us, especially since you don't have any idea about a premise of a show called The Mickey Mouse Club. It was weird.
True, this is, TV was still in... Kids' TV was still in its infancy. Disneyland was just getting started. So,
yes.
What were the mouse ears made of?
They were beautifully made. They were the finest quality felt. And the ears were wired so they didn't flop around. And the girls had beautiful red satin bows. And we used to bobby pin them on. And... they were very expensive. I mean, in those days, I guess they cost about $50 each. And if we accidentally laid them down on the set and couldn't find them anymore, they came out of our pay.
Were you ever in that position? Did you ever get fined?
I lost three pairs of ears. And yes, they came out of my pay. So we made sure that we left those bobby pins in and didn't lay them around anymore.
What was the code of conduct for the Mouseketeers?
Well, I think with anyone who works at the Disney studio, it's kind of an unsaid, unspoken understanding. You're just a nice person, morally and physically. You just respect everyone there so much, especially Mr. Disney.
Did the Mouseketeers have boyfriends and girlfriends in the club? Did you have boyfriends in the Mouse Club?
Oh, you bet we did. I was crazy about Lonnie. Lonnie was a gorgeous blonde-haired boy with the great pompadour and a good dancer, an excellent singer, and I thought he was the most suave, debonair man I had ever met. And we went steady, and I think each Mouseketeer girl had her favorite guy that probably went steady with.
How did Mr. Disney feel about this?
He didn't know. No, it was all good, clean fun. And, you know, there was no reason to tell him anything like that.
Well, he probably would have disapproved, don't you think?
Oh, I don't think so. No way. We were just such good friends, and we always had good, clean fun. And I think Mr. Disney approved of just about everything we did.
You write that you got so much fan mail, yet early on in the Mouse Club, you didn't know it because Disney kept a lot of those letters from you. He didn't want you to know how much you had caught on. Why didn't he want you to know?
Well, I think the first year especially, even into the second year, some Mouseketeers were getting more than others. So he didn't want any of us, I guess, to feel superior to any of the others. He didn't want any jealousy. And I think he was always so wise in every decision he made.
What was your favorite day of the week? Let's see, Friday was Talent Roundup Day.
That was my favorite.
Oh, okay.
I loved it. I was always interested in horses and, you know, being a cowgirl. And it was great fun. All the days of the week meant something. We had different themes. Monday was fun with music. Tuesday was guest star day. Wednesday was anything can happen day. Thursday was circus day. And then Friday was my favorite, talent roundup day.
Annette Funicello, recorded in 1994.
Saddle your pony, here we go, down to the talent rodeo. Gather up Susie, Jack, and Joe, join the talent roundup.
Round them up, bring them in, everybody's sure to win. Step right up, here we go, oh, what a rodeo.
Bring along Dinah, Bob, and Bill, ask everybody on the hill. We're gonna have a great big thrill, join the talent roundup.
Coming up, Mr. Rogers, this is Fresh Air. On this final day of our series on television, we're focusing on children's TV.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood.
Several generations of kids have grown up watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which premiered on public TV in 1968 and is now the longest-running kid show on network TV. One of Fred Rogers' sweaters is on permanent display in the Smithsonian's Popular Culture Collection. Adults sometimes find the show remarkably low-key, but their children who watch get totally involved with Mr. Rogers as he talks and sings to them. For Fred Rogers, children's TV is more than a job. It's a calling, one which he continued with even after he was ordained as a minister in the United Presbyterian Church. In 1984, I asked Fred Rogers what he was like as a child.
I was an only child. I had to make up a lot of my friends myself, and I think that was the beginning of the whole neighborhood of make-believe. I had a very rich fantasy life.
What were the friends that you had imagined?
I didn't imagine them. I had puppets, and so I would play with the puppets. And I can't remember their exact forms, but I knew that they were important to me. I think that all of the puppets in the neighborhood of make-believe are facets of who I am.
Was there somebody in your life who was the kind of figure for you, like you've become to so many children, who would, you know, like reassure you and, you know, want to discuss things with you? Of course, you can't actually step out of the TV and discuss it with all the kids, but you offer that to them. Was there someone like that for you?
I guess the closest person was my grandfather, Mr. McFeely. And, of course, we've named the Speedy Delivery Man for him. We called him Ding Dong because he taught us that childhood rhyme, Ding Dong Bell, Pussy in the Well. and everybody called him Ding Dong. He was the kind of person who would really support your strivings for autonomy. And while my parents and my grandmother were naturally very concerned about my health and hazards around, he was the kind of person who, when I would walk on one of his stone walls, for instance, and they would say, "Better get down." Ding Dong would say, "Ah, let the kid walk on the wall. He's got to learn to do things for himself."
What were the things that really scared you when you were a child?
I think the most scary thing was being alone and thinking that maybe nobody would come to get me. And I think that beginning school was tough for me. That's probably why I've done so much work for children in this area. I think also I was frightened of the doctor, and that's probably why I've made all those videotapes about helping children know about what hospitalization is like before they go. Probably why I wrote that song, "I Like to Be Told," because I did. I liked to be told about things before I had to go do them.
Did you like scary movies or books?
I can't remember.
Did you go to the movies a lot?
I would go to the movies. It's hard for me to remember. I remember a couple movies that I liked. Shirley Temple. And I liked those kinds of stories that, she would always come out okay at the end. And I met Shirley Temple Black not too long ago, and I just sat beside her in awe. And I said, it was interesting because the first thing I said to her was, "You were one of my favorite people." She said, "Were?" That was the first thing she said. And that really put me back. I expected her to say something about, I'm really glad that I could have been part of your childhood. But all she said was, "Were? I was one of your favorite people." Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. Did she diminish in your esteem after saying that?
A little bit. But I think that so many people you put on pedestals when you see them from afar, and it's probably just not fair to expect them to be as wonderful as you thought they would be when you met them.
What about when you were a teenager? Was that an uncomfortable experience, or did you feel like you fit in with everybody in high school, which is, I think, a pretty traumatic time for a lot of people when they're growing up?
It sure is. I think that teenage years are probably uncomfortable for everybody. It's just that some seem to be able to carry it off with more elan than others. But it was tough for me at the beginning. And then I made a couple friends who found out that the core of me was okay. And one of them was the president or the head of the football team. He later became my best friend in high school, and we've carried on that friendship for a long, long time. As a matter of fact, his daughter's getting married next week in La Trobe, and we're all part of that wedding together. But that's a long, long time ago. We graduated in 1946. But it was after the beginning of that friendship that I was more accepted in school. Then I became the editor of the yearbook and finally the president of the student council by the end of high school. But I was a very shy person going into high school.
What did you think you were going to be when you got out of school and started a professional career?
I thought I was going to be a diplomat and was thinking about going to a school for diplomacy. And then I changed my mind, and this was during college. I wanted to be a minister and was all set to go to seminary after college. But I saw this thing called television, and I saw people throwing pies in each other's faces and all kinds of demeaning behavior. And I thought, I would really like to try my hand at that and see what I could do. And so instead of going to the seminary after graduation, I got a job at NBC in New York and went there for 2 years before joining educational television.
Worked on the Hit Parade and the Kate Smith Hour, I think.
Mm-hmm. The Voice of Firestone and all of those programs.
It surprises me, I think, that you left for a fledgling station, a brand new station in educational television, which was also new. It sounds like it was very risky to do that. Why did you make that switch?
I don't know. Pittsburgh was closer to where I grew up. Maybe I wanted to, I had just gotten married in New York, and maybe I had wanted to go back. I'm not sure that's so. I think that it had to do with wanting to work with children, because every day that I had off at NBC, I would go and visit a daycare center or an orphanage or a hospital that cared for children. And I cannot tell you why. I'm sure it had very deep roots. But when I got to Pittsburgh, and I, and there were only three or four of us working at QED then, we weren't even on the air. This was in November of 53, and we didn't go on the air until April of 54, 30 years ago. One of the secretaries and I did a children's program together because nobody else wanted to do a children's program. But we were doing all of these other things as well. Each of us had a salary of $75 a week. And out of our own pockets, we bought all of the props for the program. And we called the program the Children's Corner. And it was on an hour every day. And I expected that I would play the organ for the hostess to sing. She would introduce all of the films, which I, as the producer, would get from all over the country. They had to be free because we didn't have any budget. Well, I didn't realize it, but those films were very brittle at times. And, of course, everything was live, and we'd be on the air, and here would be a film showing, and it would break. We'd have to fill with something. And so the night before we went on the air, Mrs. Dorothy Daniel, who was the general manager of the station, gave me a little tiger puppet. So I called him Daniel for her. And when the first film broke, I just poked the puppet through, and this was just a very fanciful set with drawings on it. And I just poked him through, and it happened to be a clock where I poked him through. And he just said,
it's 5:02, and Columbus discovered America in 1492.
And that was the first thing that I ever said through puppetry on the air.
Wow.
But I just wanted you to know that necessity there was the mother of that invention, because it hadn't been planned. And so much that is spontaneous is what can be truly inspired. And I feel that all that I've done that's been really helpful and good has been inspired.
You went back to the seminary after doing children's programming for a while, right?
Well, I started with the station, and after we got that children's program going, it got to be so busy for us that the secretary and I both gave up all of our other duties to do the Children's Corner. As it got moving, the second year, I decided I would go to the seminary, so I went on my lunch hour and took courses just one at a time, never expecting that I would get graduate. It took me 8 years, and I finally graduated and was ordained a minister in the Presbyterian Church.
Obviously, you're very religious, but I don't think you... it's not a denominational program, and I'm sure that's intentional on your part.
It's far from denominational and far from overtly religious. The last thing in the world that I would want to do would be something that's exclusive. I would hate to think that a child would feel excluded from the neighborhood by something that I said and did.
We're listening to a 1984 interview with Fred Rogers. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1984 interview with Fred Rogers of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Well, what do you think about television and children? A lot of parents don't want their kids to watch TV. And I know you're really sensitive about how media affects children. You do a TV show that's, I think, unlike any others. Do you think that television is necessarily good or necessarily bad for kids?
I think that a lot of it has to do with what the child is bringing to the television experience, that the drama within that child is going to determine how he or she will see a certain thing. So many people have talked about our work with such a simple thing as helping children understand that they can't go down the bathtub drain. And, you know, I sing that song, "You can never go down, can never go down, can never go down the drain." Well, if a child is very concerned about the loud rush of the flush of either the bathtub or the toilet and comes to the neighborhood on a day when I am talking about that, that will be highly dramatic for that child. That child will focus in on what I'm talking about and showing much more than if there were some very loud cartoon or all kinds of fancy production going on. And so it's the inner drama of the viewer and the listener that means so much in communication. You know, this Who's listening to us right now? What are their concerns? What are they worried about? What gives them joy? I'd love to know, because I think that radio and television and these things are very personal media. The reason that I have worked all these years with children and with parents, is that I want to know at least the general things that people are concerned about so that I can speak to them and dramatize them as creatively as I know how.
Something that you really do is talk about what kids are scared of instead of just doing the clown bit. You know, having a clown is going to entertain them. Why do you focus on that? Because like a lot of your songs and sometimes on the show too, it's about... what's making kids nervous? It's not an attempt to just, like, entertain them and make them laugh, you know?
I'd like them to know that there are things inside them that are okay to talk about. and they might feel anxious about them. And I feel that somebody needs to tell them that it's all right to talk about what they're scared of, what makes them angry, what makes them sad, what makes them happy. They should know that there is a full array of emotions in life, and all of them are fine. It's what we do with them that matters. And I like to think that the neighborhood is a kind of smorgasbord of ways to deal with how we feel. For me, it was always music and puppets. That's the way I dealt with how I felt. For others, it might be dance or welding or building with blocks. I could go on for a half an hour about all of the ways that we offer kids. We show them so many ways of healthy sublimation that I like to think that is a major part of what we do.
Can I just ask you one more thing before we go? You know how a lot of adults always say, God, I wish I was a child again. Do you ever wish you were 5 or 10 or 12?
Yes, but I'd like to be that with what I know now. And I think that I'd like that because there are a good many significant people in my life that I have lost through death, and I'd like to be able to talk with them again and tell them some things that I wasn't able to tell them then. In fact, I'd like to be able to tell them, you are special.
Fred Rogers recorded in 1984, and that concludes Fresh Air series on TV. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's program on children's TV was produced by Anne-Marie Baldonado with Megan Howell. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. I'm Terry Gross. Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, SaabUSA.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to members of the band La Tigra, Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman. Hanna fronted the 90s riot girl band Bikini Kill. Fateman is an artist and zine writer. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.